Thanks, Alistair. And I'd like to invite my colleagues, Nicole Feast, Georgia Kinzo, and Ming Jingya to join me on stage. My three colleagues are PhD candidates, and I just thought I was going to talk about a program, but what better way to talk about a program than actually to introduce those who are part of the program. So we're talking about hunting in packs, building collaborative research cultures, and I'll explain that term in a little while. So we'll just jump straight into it. Okay, so before beginning, of course, I too want to acknowledge on behalf of the four of us that we are meeting on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and pay respects to elders past, present, and of course, future. And I really thought that first panel where we talked about the international students or the international candidate talked about the lack of connection between international visitors and the history of this amazing nation of ours. Good, bad and ugly is so important for us to work on, and I'll talk about that as well. Now, I was going to present a number of memes, but, you know, yesterday Pat presented memes, and I thought, how do you top a presentation based on memes? Well, I'm going to try and top it by showing you a photo of me in 1986, which was my first day at university. This is what I looked like when I turned up at UNSW. To attend my first day at uni. It was not a boy band. I just want to confirm that it's not a boy band. So I was the first member of my family to go to university. Mum ironed for a living and Dad carried bricks for a living. And so I always get a bit emotional and like pretty freaked out when I think what I get to do compared to their lives coming over as migrants from Greece. And, you know, that classic migrant story. And education for me is the pathway to so many opportunities. So I just want to always acknowledge those who you as educators who have done so many things to take our students on an incredible journey, be it PhDs and also undergraduates. So format today, I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes and set the scene. Then I'm going to ask each of our researchers to talk about their experience. So they'll give you a bit of an overview of what they're researching, and I think it's important to hear the diversity of the research. And then they're gonna talk about the challenges they face, because it's not all beer and Skittles, and then they're gonna talk about what they would like to see if they could change one thing. But before proceeding, I wanna thank Alistair and Lee for always putting on such an amazing program. I want to thank all the presenters who I got to see, and you were amazing. And I also want to thank Tim for your lovely, warm welcome, and hearing your personal journey is so valuable. And then finally, I also want to thank my colleagues from Western Australia's five universities, some of them who are here today, Chris and Imelda, and incredible work that you do in making the Forest Research Foundation, and Gretchen, of course, making the Forest Research Foundation such an incredible place to work. So, let's get into it. So what is the Forest Research Foundation? Well, it was established, and I'll talk about this in a bit more detail, but essentially it's been established to help create Western Australia as a global knowledge, research and creative hub. Western Australia is known as a place where you dig and you extract. And the vision of the Forest Research Foundation is to actually change that world, change Western Australia, and think about what we want Western Australia to look like in 100 years' time. So it's actually a generational project. It's not something that's going to benefit the state immediately, although I think it does benefit the five universities pretty quickly. But the vision that the projects that we do or the work that we fund is often blue sky research. So it's, we've got people looking for black hole, hidden black holes and things like that. So the model overview of how we operate is that we were established in 2014 following the largest ever philanthropic donation by Andrew and Nicola Forrest of $130 million. And we had our first intake of PhD graduates or PhD students in 2015. And the idea is to attract early career researchers to one of the five Perth-based universities. So we work across all five universities, which makes us unique, right? Not many institutions exist to operate across the five universities. The second thing that makes us unique is that we have no theme except for excellence and now engagement. That is, we have astrophysicists, oceanographers, we have soil scientists, we have soil scientists, everyone loves a good soil scientist. We have someone writing the first history of Australia's literary awards. We have neuroscientists, biomedical engineers. We are a diverse group of researchers. So no theme across five universities. And the way we were set up was we built essentially, of the $130 million, $50 million went to build a mini campus, two buildings side by side known as a forest precinct. I love my boss, but he's not modest. So the forest precinct essentially has two buildings side by side. Those buildings have 55 apartments, ranging from studios to three bedrooms. And so when you receive your award, your forest scholarship or your forest fellowship, you get to live in the forest precinct. You get to live at one of these apartments. And that's the third thing that makes us unique. So we have 55 apartments, and with the $80 million, it sits in the corpus, managed independently by the University of Western Australia, and we have enough money for a steady state of 60 researchers. And we're about 52 researchers at the moment. We'll hit the steady state in about 2026, because we'll get some and lose some as they graduate and they move on. And as I said, we all live at Forest Hall. I don't live there, but they all live at Forest Hall in this kind of community, in this sort of mini precinct. We have three programs that we fund. We fund a forest scholars or PhD scholarships, and they're funded for up to 4 years. Now, what's important is the university funds the first 3.5 years of stipend, and we fund the last 6 months. So the other thing that I think makes us unique, I suppose if I want to talk about the third thing that makes us unique, is that we give time. So speed of submission is not one of our measures. We take on researchers who are often going to take on brave blue sky projects, and we recognise the fact that going against the grain often, that we're not going to try and force people to finish within, you know, as close to 3 years as possible. We accept the fact that it's going to take longer than that. We also have postdoctoral fellowships for 3 years, and they're employed, and the full costs are covered by the foundation, so they get paid on the level A, step eight, so it's about $99,800 or something. And then we also have a creative and performing fellowship program, so we have artists in residence. Now, you've got to imagine, 90%, even though we have no theme, of course, who gets attracted to the universities of the five universities in WA generally tend to be science heavy. Not only scientists, but science heavy. So having humanities and creative component in the program creates a different dimension. We have different conversations. And if I get a chance, I'll talk about that. So in addition to the stipend and the wage, we also offer accommodation, either free or subsidised, depending on the program you're on. Heavily subsidised, but essentially free for everyone there. We offer a $12,000 research allowance, which is for the researchers to pursue their work, a relocation allowance, and access to our unique researcher journey, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail. Now, here's the kicker, right? In addition to this is so bizarre. In addition to having a 55 rooms next to Forest Hall or part of the Forest Precinct is a boutique 66 room hotel managed by a corps called the Wannal. Wannal being the Noongar word for peppermint, because a lot of peppermint trees are on the Swan River. And the profits flow back into the foundation. So last year the profits were about $800,000, and this year we're estimating about $1 million to flow back into the foundation to help fund our programs. So I sit on the board of the hotel. Pretty bizarre, something I never thought I'd say. What's a sociologist know about running a hotel? Nothing at all, it works out. But I'm learning a lot, and that's part of the thing I love about this job, is that every day it's like this unique adventure. So I'm learning about how to operate a hotel, I'm learning about room per night, I'm learning all these really weird things. And it's fascinating, it's such a cool thing to do. So it's part of the fun of working at the foundation. So I want to talk about our strategy, because that'll set the scene for what we're trying to achieve. Because our first strategy is really focused on the 60 researchers. So we have what we call the unique researcher journey, that looks at how we onboard, how we mentor, how we develop the professional development programs we offer, all the way through to having a very strong and vibrant alumni network. Now, we're very lucky in the sense of you introduced an alumni strategy when you got like 20 alumni. It's kind of easy to find them and to bring them into the fold. And so yesterday we had our, Tuesday night we had our first ever out-of-state alumni dinner. Two people turned up because there are two graduates here from the Forest Foundation. One of them was actually our first ever graduate, Timothy Hammer, who actually works at the Herbarium and is associated with Adelaide Uni, and Usher Kroger, who is at Flinders, right? And it was really great. And we've got this like a little thing where we keep in contact with our alumni. So all the way through, and the alumni play a quite a unique role in our program. And so this is an overview of the kind of thing that we plan everyone to do. And I won't go through the detail, but we have a number of strategies, a number of steps we want to develop the researchers. And that's the important thing, is that we don't just think about the research, but we think about the researchers. Again, picking up on what Tim said earlier, it's about the research and not just the researchers. So it's about developing, and that culture of what it means, identity, and all those things that we've been talking about the last 3 days have really played a major role in the way that we run the foundation. And even our orientations are multidimensional. So our orientations include the standard orientation that you would have, getting the most out of your Forest Research Foundation experience. But then we have time with Noongar elders, which is really important for them to understand the history, and that includes for our international students, as well as our national students, confronting some of those gaps that we identified in day one. We have time with librarians and the support that librarians provide and how to do citation sessions. That's been specifically designed, and we work with the librarians across the universities to do that. We run a respectful research cultures program. So again, looking at how to run a respectful research lab and so on. And finally, we actually introducing this year is a reading club on the history and philosophy of science, history and philosophy of research, to talk about knowledge and introduce, you know, everything from Thomas Kuhn to the decolonization of science and so on, everything in between. So we're kicking that off this year for the first time, kicking that off in June this year. And these are some of the topics that we cover as part of the researcher journey. Again, I can talk about these in detail, but I'm just mindful of the time. But everything from professional development, how to become a mentor, not only to be mentored, to personal development, on thriving, not surviving in academia, to thought leadership, things like the science-law interface, or from research to policy. Really important stuff, I think, that's important for our researchers to be exposed to. So the second part of our strategic program is to move beyond the 60 researchers and think about how we, as a organisation that is well-resourced, can help shape the Western Australian research community or ecosystem. So we have a number of programs that actually allow us to bring in early career researchers from across the 5 universities. So here's some samples. Lynn Beasley and the Australian Academy of Science ran a program from research to policy, how policy is made, again exposing our researchers to how these complex processes work. How to talk to a politician. Again, we bring in researchers from across the 5 universities. Here we are hosting the Square Kilometre Array International Council, came and spent some time with us. And again, we had a public forum and brought in astrophysicists from across the 5, from across the universities, mainly Curtin and UWA, but others came as well. And Professor Jagadesh from the Australian Academy of Science came and we ran a workshop about developing your research career both in and out of academia. So it's really exciting to have to be able to impact those beyond the 60 researchers and impact the broader early career research community across the 5 universities. And the third thing we do is run a thought leadership program with partners. The Australian Institute for International Affairs is one. We're running a program called Policy Taboos with the Public Policy Institute based at UWA. And that's really important to actually expose our researchers to the debates that are happening. And some of them are about making them uncomfortable. So we partnered with the Australian Institute for International Affairs with a session with Tony Abbott, the former Prime Minister. It was not something that, you know, I think you'd do for fun. It's quite a confronting presentation by Tony, but really important that they hear what a skeptic sounds like. And here's Peter Van Olsen, media commentator, really interesting guy, become a friend, don't agree with a lot of what he says, but really really confronting or really interesting insights into working with politicians and, again, running sessions. So this is just a sort of breakfast roundtable that we had with him recently. Other programs that we run are Distinguished Visiting Fellows Program, Visiting Fellows. We're launching a Thinker in Residence program this year. We have Public Engagement Program, as I mentioned, and Building Partnership with the Lurton Academies. And we've got two really close relationships with two of the academies and building relationships with the other Lurton Academies as well. So here are the provocations, and I want to just spend the next sort of 10 minutes before passing it over to my colleagues about what drives us, and hopefully picks up some of the themes that we've been talking about. Because really, if I think of myself as a director, we have a very stringent research recruitment process and work very closely with the universities to recruit. So the researchers that we get are going to do amazing things regardless. So what is it that we bring apart from a sort of a campus and accommodation and things like that? And I like to think that what we do is really focus on building cultures of collaboration. So here are the provocations that drive us. And the first one was really driven by one of our independent board members, former DVCR at UWA, Robin Owens, who says researchers go further when we hunt in packs. So when we collaborate, when we work together, when we actually share each other's research, when we swap papers and ask each other to read those applications, when we share what we fail as well as what we succeed in. So it's about building that culture of together. And so what we want is people to see the research, the Forest Research Foundation, and go, that everyone associated with that is going to do good stuff because they work together. It's that collaborative model. The second one, again, builds up on what Tim said, which is from one of our alumnus, Dr. Jacob Martin, who said, quote unquote, astrophysics is easy. He's an astrophysicist, physicist, chemist. He says, astrophysics is easy, people are hard. So this is where you bring the humanities into it. This is where you bring in communications and engagement understanding into it. So it's not just about the science, right? And this, again, goes against the grain of disciplinary boundaries. It's about building these cultures where we teach our scientists, even our hardcore scientists, to engage, to communicate, to work hard, to understand the philosophy of what we're trying to do. Building communities of practice. And here's a quote from science communicator Stephen Johnson, which says, innovation doesn't come from giving people incentives. It comes from creating environments where ideas can connect. So we've had some really great, some of the collaborations we run. We run this fortnightly PhD surgery where people come, present and share ideas. People come along, we provide pizza, and people just sit around and just share their research and share ideas. And from that spun a bunch of really interesting collaborations. That's crossed all boundaries. So recently, one of our scientists, Jacob, we mentioned him before, he worked with one of our artists in residence, Dr. Andrea Russell, and they went to India to present, they just took an exhibition of how to imagine a virtual reality program of an atom traveling through a battery, a carbon atom, through a carbon-based battery, and took that to India to the Bangalore Art Science Museum there, and it's doing a bit of a tour. Amazing work, right? Again, not many chances for these different disciplines to come together and interact. Another one is this one: as mammals, we learn through play, curiosity, and fun. And you know, Robert Galazzo, who runs a really amazing organisation called the Finch Company, they make films and they do a whole bunch of really cool design stuff. He always says, "We've got so much technology, but we often lack imagination." And again, you bring people together, you get them to play with ideas, and they develop, and that imagination takes hold. So the fifth one is embracing curiosity, innovation, and mistakeability to create brave spaces, replacing fear with curiosity. And so some of you know that I've been working on this model of the citizen scholar, which has basically been aimed at undergraduates, I suppose. Most of the work I've been doing is with undergraduates. But I have developed it also over the last couple of years, been developing this idea of the academic citizen scholar. What are the skills? How do we develop our academics? What do we want to bring to them? Like, what are the things that we want it to look like as academics? What are our learning outcomes? What are the things that we do that are really important, that with the skills that we take away? And so we've been working around this idea of mistakeability, learning from your mistakes, creating brave spaces, accepting the fact that we're going to be confronted with things we're uncomfortable about. But they should be learning moments. We shouldn't shy away from those challenge, from the challenges that we have. And again, when we work as a group, we try and do that together. A couple more to go through. The sixth one is this idea of pragmatic idealism, never letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. The Forrest family made their money through through mining and other extractive industries. And people say to me, like when I first accepted the job, I had a whole bunch of friends call me a sellout and some less polite terms. But the idea, you know, working with someone like Michael Sheldrick from Global Citizen, who has raised $40 billion working with organisations like the Forrest Foundation to confront global poverty projects. Let me say that again, $40 billion. The idea is results, right? Not taking a moral high stance. And so Michael always challenges me to say, who are you working with and what's your outcome? What is it about that you're trying to achieve? Not about, if you feel comfortable doing it, if you feel uncomfortable doing it, ask yourself why. And so we accept the fact that it's a complex world. And our researchers need to understand that money comes from all sorts of weird places. And I remember a friend saying to me, who had just received a nice grant from Create New South Wales, criticised me for working for the Forest Research Foundation and Andrew Forrest. And I reminded her that the New South Wales government is the largest money laundering organisation in the world. More, 35% of all poker machines outside casinos are in the New South Wales. And that's where that money comes from. So it's a, you know, it's again, it's about what you feel comfortable with and confronting that reality. We don't shy away from those debates, and it's really important. And then number seven is our partners are part of the community. Without them, our journey is not fulfilling. I said that. I quoted myself. I know. And that's really important. The moment someone arrives, and not to pick anyone out, but for example, Nicole is doing a PhD. Her partner, Elliot, is an amazing researcher. The moment they arrived together, Elliot became part of the foundation. He gets exposed and invited to everything we do. It's not about saying, oh, your partner can't come to this. They get invited to everything we do. We need to take our partners along on our journey. And finally, the last point to make is that researcher-led programs are an opportunity for our researchers to learn leadership, to learn skills, to learn governance. And so we co-design what we do with them. And there was a really great session from a couple of researchers from RMIT? Was it RMIT? No, Flinders. Where were they from? Anyway, it doesn't matter. So where were you? You. Yeah, yeah. So that stuff is really great. And I think it's important that we design our programs with our researchers. Now, I hear what you're saying. Whatevs. You're well-funded. You got money, you can do it. And it's true, we are well-funded. And some things cost money. And I'll talk about what costs money. But what doesn't cost money are pizzas. They don't cost a lot of money. A couple hundred dollars for pizzas and beer every couple of weeks is not a lot of money. And we do serve alcohol at our functions, something that we as a community have agreed to do. What doesn't cost a lot of money is making sure we have child mining available for our researchers so our female researchers can pay attention when we have a program. What doesn't cost a lot of money is the roundtables with guests that are visiting different universities, and I'll call them and say, hey, I heard so-and-so is coming to university. Can they come and visit us for a morning session or a roundtable or something? What doesn't cost a lot of money is engaging with our PhD, employing our PhD representatives for a couple of hours a week to make sure they get paid for the work that they do. And what also doesn't cost a lot of money is a peer-to-peer review and the mentoring from the alumni, right? That's things that's an obligation that we all carry. So yeah, things cost money. We're lucky to be able to afford small grants. We're lucky to be able to fly people to Perth and put them up at the hotel. And we're lucky that we can actually have a decent budget for our researchers, but it's not all about money, right? So yeah, we do have good resources, but there's also a lot of things that we do that don't cost us a lot of money. And it's that culture of collaboration that I really want to share with you and really encourage you to think about. Student-led programs, cultures of collaboration, people working together, and taking advantage of the opportunities you have. And my final thought before passing it on is that, yeah, again, as Tim said, a PhD is a challenging process, but it's also an amazing experience. We're so privileged to undertake a PhD. That doesn't take away none of the hard parts and the challenges and all those things. But it's also an amazing process, and we need to keep on reminding ourselves how lucky we are as educators to be able to undertake a deep journey of knowledge. So one of the things that I always challenge my colleagues is to say, what are we doing to ensure that our researchers have that sense of agency for their careers, be it in academia or outside academia? So I'm going to leave it at that, and I am going to pass over to Nicole Feast to talk about her research. Thank you. Let's just press the green one to go forward.
Awesome. Thanks, James. So hello, everyone. It's an honour and a privilege to be able to speak with you today. So my name is Nicole Feast, and I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Western Australia, which I'm completing with funding support from the Forest Research Foundation as a forest scholar. As James has already mentioned, I'm first going to spend a few minutes talking about my research, followed by a couple of reflections related to my experience as a forest scholar and how I envision some of the experiences could possibly translate to other settings and institutions. So my PhD research project is called the ENHANCE Trial, Evaluating Neuropsychological Assessment to Enhance Clinical Outcomes for People with Brain Conditions. And my research team spans beyond Western Australia to include collaborators in Melbourne and the USA. And I actually grew up in Mount Gambier, so it's great to be back in South Australia. So firstly, you may be wondering what exactly is neuropsychology? So neuropsychological assessment is the evaluation of cognitive, psychological, and behavioural functioning to assist diagnostic clarification and management of a wide range of neurological and mental health conditions. And as part of that, then thinking about what exactly is cognition, it includes abilities such as attention, memory, and executive functioning, so organization, abstract reasoning, problem solving. These cognitive abilities are very important for completing a PhD as well. But in a clinical context, neuropsychological assessment might investigate the possibility of an emerging dementia, presence of any cognitive impairments following a stroke or head injury, and identify cognitive strengths and weaknesses in some chronic mental health conditions as well. So that's just some of the queries that we might tackle. And so in considering the context of my PhD project, there are barriers for individuals to access adequate intervention and assessment for cognitive impairments, with long wait lists for neuropsychological assessment in the public health sector, high costs in the private sector, and difficulties accessing neuropsychology services in both metro and regional areas. So for example, a report by the Stroke Foundation in 2019 found that there were less than 50% of metro services and only 13% of regional services that had access to neuropsychology. And there have been calls by policymakers and my scientific community for high-quality randomized controlled trials investigating patient outcomes following neuropsychological assessment. And I'm completing my trial in partnership with the WA Department of Health, utilising a novel tool for assessing patient outcomes, which I'm really excited about. And my research thus has the potential for some real-world impact through informing evidence-based clinical practice and policy related to the management of brain conditions, both in Australia and worldwide. So that's up there, the dream that I have as an HDR student in the impact that my research might have and make a difference for both my clinical profession but also the patients and the families that we work with. And so now I'm going to shift gears a little bit in sharing with you some of my personal reflections on how the research environment and community building at Forest Research Foundation is enhancing my own experience as a HDR student. So firstly, in thinking about the title of this talk, Hunting in Packs, this section continues the theme about how can we create a pack mentality among PhD students. So firstly, in my view, starting a PhD benefits from a university factory reset and moving from competition to collaboration. So students to this point, you're taught, get the grades, get into the thing, prove you're the best. But then once you're here, you're doing the thing. So how we can collaborate and work together and thinking that if one of us succeeds, we're all succeeding at the Forest Research Foundation. And from a university environment, there can be this real messaging around publish or perish to new PhD students. And I guess what I believe is that Forest Research Foundation is really cultivating this different research culture related to foster and flourish, about how we can all sort of band together in this community, improve research culture, and be both a safe harbour from any research-related storms that might occur, but then also a launch pad into success and how we celebrate each other in that. And I've heard the terms foster and flourish many times throughout the last few days. I've been keeping a little grid, and like every time someone says those words, I tick it. So it seems to be a real theme here in this community. And so the next point I wanted to make in thinking about, there have been a number of talks over the last few days that have also really pointed this out, that completing a PhD can be isolating. So it's great to hear in this community that you're aware that that's the experience of PhD students, and I personally felt heard and validated. So thank you for putting your brilliant minds to how to tackle this. And I guess, so how do you build a sense of community when you don't have perhaps don't have a lab, you don't have coursework to go to with your peers, I guess, in this new sense of wanting to forge some friendships and peer connections? And as James has already mentioned, at Forest Research Foundation, we've got these great things called PhD surgeries, which are really, by the name, surgery to dissect a problem facing PhD students, whether it be how to bring in some creativity into your research, how to write for grants, tackling some supervisor difficulties. And the important thing too is that it's really peer-led and peer-to-peer, so James doesn't usually come to them, or other professors, so it's just students tackling these issues together, and it's across disciplines, astrophysicists, literature people, all sorts, and across career stage. So there's first year PhD students, final year PhD students, and also research fellows post PhD, and how that kind of informal mentoring happens is really, really powerful. And the third point that I wanted to make is that Forest Research Foundation is really good at leveraging existing supports. So there are a lot of great initiatives that are happening at universities, great institutes, and as he's pointed out with his public policy related at UWA, some public policy groups that he gets involved with, and I guess talking to one another, pooling those resources, inviting PhD students along to them, and to get that sort of ability to practice those soft skill developments with a PhD, valuing the work in networking and really encouraging students to do that, and also pursuing those thought leadership opportunities. And there's been some great discussion here at the conference as well around putting the PhD, the PH back into the PhD. So that thought leadership really applies there. So the next session relates to some reflections on potential barriers to the hunt. And really, we're expected as PhD students to conduct an innovative, cutting-edge PhD, never been done before, and as we heard this morning as well, it's not a one-size-fits-all exercise. And so I guess having some of those tick box procedures and the kind of bureaucracy throughout the uni that potentially others experience as well, but just how that impacts HDR students. And while I do appreciate that research to support teams are working with hundreds of PhD students and that they all have different needs, but there have been lots of restructures and loss of staff. Me, myself, before starting a PhD, I used to work in a research office, and I was at a university when the pandemic hit, so I really try my best to understand what that's like. But I guess just thinking about how we can still have these personalised and flexibility related to our innovative students as well. The other point I was thinking related to barriers to the hunt is this lack of administrative support for supervisors, in that there might be some potential additional tasks for a PhD student to complete that's flowed down from the supervisors being very busy, but also just the general stress and high pace that supervisors tend to be at. They've got these huge workloads, you're getting emails at all times of day, weekends, and just how that kind of flows down to the PhD students. So I would really advocate for administrative support for supervisors. And if I could change one thing about the PhD experience, it would be university-led efforts to build cohort identity among PhD students. In thinking about, we've had a great talk yesterday about how this could really be driven by peers too, but I've been myself really trying to develop that, and it's tiring and it's a lot, and if there was a little bit of extra ideas from the university as well, that would be great. Something simple like thinking about which research office spaces you offer to new students, running those earlier workshops together within the school so that they can really band together and figure out who their cohort is. So yeah, to support the PhD students to find their very own pack to undertake the what can be a very stressful 3.5 year long hunt with. So thank you very much. Thank you. And I'll now pass over to my peer and friend, Ming Jing.
And thank you, Nicole. And so first, I'll begin with a short introduction of myself, and I will give you a brief rundown of my research, and I'll talk about my own experience at the Forest Research Foundation. So I'm Ming Xing, and I'm a biomedical engineer. I just joined Forest last year, and this is actually the beginning of my second year at the Forest Research Foundation. And so first, beginning with my research topic, I'm redesigning a biocompatible implant for bone regeneration. So first you may ask that there's a lot of implant already, and why are we doing this? So you know how that bone fractures impact over 1.6 million Australians annually? Well, actually, this is not only lead to impaired quality of life, but also to an undisclosed number of deaths. Internationally, the estimated number of no fractures is 178 million per annum. And in addition to that, the economic burden is actually predicted to be 33 billion over the next 10 years. And just despite these staggering statistics, our medical facilities often do not provide patients with proper treatment. The current implants have multiple problems, including not only metal allergies, but also, in worst cases, mechanical failures. And what that means? So this means the implant would actually break into half, and which causes instability and exacerbates patient suffering. So what am I developing? So as you can see on the very left is the implant material that we're making at University of Western Australia. So my current research involves using a composite material called carbon fiber reinforced PEEK. This polymer material is bioinert and biocompatible. So my research involves adding short, strong, and flexible fibers, which are used to make bulletproof vests to strengthen the implant on a microstructural level. And by doing this, we're hoping to see an implant that will fully support patients' movements during their weight-bearing exercise and alleviate the risk of infection and implant failure. And continuing, I have three talking points to give you what I experienced at Forest Hall and what I would like to share. And so the first thing is how we work towards solutions as a pack. So my experience is that as PhD student, we all meet setbacks at some point in our PhD. Sometimes it's about having technical problems really hard to solve, and not having sufficient fundings or just struggling with upward management. And in my very own experience, I was not able to continue my research due to the lack of lab equipment. and our group lacked funding and collaboration to purchase such a device. So I was really stuck, and I needed help. The first thing that I did was go to the postdocs at the Forrest Fund Foundation for help. And I must emphasize the two people that I turned to are not researchers in my field. And they are Sam Starko, a marine biologist, and Andrea Russell, a creative artist. And despite having different specializations, they both suggested me to apply for grants. And I found an internal funding scheme, and my supervisor has also agreed to support me as a secondary chief investigator in the application. And when I was riding the ground, I really struggled, as this is my first time. But the two postdocs mentored me and provided writing support along the way. Moreover, just before submission, James also provided some support, and he also helped me with editing. And in this foundation, I just feel I'm very lucky to have people here with more experience to help us as backup mentors, and all of these would not have been possible without Forrest Hall. And second, what I would like to talk about is the impact on our work. Usually that when we finish a paper, we think that, well, the communication has been completed, my research has been well communicated to the outside world, but actually, I feel there's a little bit more than that. So my supervisor is an expert in material science. He received 11 Australian Research Council grants, and he has 298 research publications. He has also successfully leaded high-performing PhD students with over 6 first authorships attributed to top graduates. He's really an excellent supervisor. However, when I asked the former students about the implications of their research and whether they intended to collaborate with my supervisor to translate their findings to solve real-world impact problems, and their responses were, we just need papers to graduate and get funding so that in the future we can help our very own students to graduate and get more funding. But just after talking to our scholars and fellows at Forrest Hall, I found that they have so many connections to external institutions, while our team currently do not have any collaborators. I came to realize that research is not just about producing papers for grants, but also stepping outside the ivory tower to create real-world impact. And ever since then, we have been developing connections with industry partners, and this includes the Australian Institute of Robotic Orthopedics, ARROW. And moreover, this Tuesday, 2 a.m. in the middle of the night, I received a message from the Technical University of Košice. And in this email, they said, your vision aligns closely with our institution's commitment to excellence in biomedical engineering in advancing medical innovation. And adding to that, they are also looking forward to having me in Slovakia and discuss collaborations. And my third point is that at Forrest Hall, how we're developed as a researcher. And this is actually being talked by being conveyed by Professor James Avantakis in the research journey at Forrest Hall. So we have at Forrest Hall, we have a Forrest Research Foundation Researchers Council. And it is a miniature democracy that serves the residents at Forrest Hall. And this council oversees a wide range of committees, including environmental, social, collaborations, and families, which fosters our residents' leadership skills. And in 2023, I had the honor of serving as the council president, and James invited me to attend the foundation's board of governors meeting, which included the 5 vice chancellors and Andrew and Nicola Forrest. I really learned a lot from their high-level discussions and strategic planning. And I really don't know any other PhD candidates who have exposure to this level of governance and has been specifically given a voice. And just aside from this, the foundation also supports entrepreneurship by encouraging researchers to attend bootcamp programs and the Center for Entrepreneurial Research and Innovation. And moreover, at the Forest Research Foundation, we have hosted numerous events last year. And actually, to be honest, at first I really found attending these events quite intimidating. But just after a year of being bombarded with loads of functionalities, and I feel I'm just tired of being scared. So standing here, having this conversation, I will not say that I'm not scared anymore, but I'm actually just more at ease facing a lot of amazing individuals in a conference like this. Sorry, I just have two more points to finish. And so the barriers to the hunt that I would like to talk about that as an international student is that we're really vulnerable in a new country. And for example, Australia has a really different healthcare system to my home country, and I have a friend at Forest Hall just waited four hours to get to the emergency, and while she's really in pain. And there's this visa problems, and it took me 3 years to get to Australia. Moreover, we have really strict timeline to finish, and we cannot just hit a pause button in our PhD and resume later. And there's also inconsistency in resourcing. And especially for people like me who's involved in those lab, and some of us will be given a really limited budget and trying to shoot for the moon, and we just ended up, just to save our budget, we have ended up doing things that is actually outside the scope of our PhD, and it's taken really a lot of our time. And if there's one thing I could change about the PhD experience, I would say that the foundation provides mentorship, but it is something often seen as a distraction from our research. So I really hope that we can purposely create mentors beyond single institutions. And this is the end of my talk, and I would like to hand over to my friend, Georgia. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name's Georgia Kinso. I'm a 2023 Forest Scholar and in my second year of my PhD at Curtin University. I have a background in biomedical engineering as well, and I'm very fortunate to work in quite a multidisciplinary team across a number of institutions, both across Perth and in the US. And I was very lucky to spend 6 months in the US at Georgia Tech learning from a lab there with the support of the foundation, and I'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. But first, I'll just tell you a little bit about my research. So my research is focused on predicting patient outcomes after heart valve replacements. And my primary supervisor is a clinician. He's an interventional cardiologist, and he spends a lot of his time replacing defective heart valves using a minimally invasive procedure called TAVR, which essentially involves placing a new heart valve over the defective heart valve to restore function back to the heart. The problem with these TAVR valves is that they degrade over time, and with people living longer, the likelihood that these will degrade within a patient's lifetime is increasing. Therefore, some patients now require redo TAVR procedures, which are quite risky procedures compared to the initial TAVR procedures, but they're necessary for patients to stay alive. So my project is focused on predicting patient outcomes after redo TAVR procedures to improve the eligibility criteria and safety of these procedures. I've had a lot of people ask me, why did you want to do a PhD over the last couple of days? And for me, one of the biggest reasons is that biomedical engineering research has the opportunity for translation from
scientific background into clinical practice. And so that's what I'm aiming to do in my PhD. And I've been really lucky so far to have spent some time in the US. So I'll just tell you a little bit about my experience there. I think so far my PhD experience has been one of some challenges, but a lot of opportunities. So I spent 6 months at Georgia Tech, which allowed me to collaborate and forge connections internationally, not just through the collaborations with the lab that I was at, but also through attending international conferences, which really allowed me to put my project into the context of my field on an international scale. And it allowed me to upskill in a number of areas, not only professionally, but also personally. It was a lot of understanding relationships between different people and understanding how to communicate. And it was also a big challenge to just move across the world for 6 months. And it also exposed me to a lot of the differences between PhDs in Australia and the US. So I've heard some people talk about this over the last few days. The US has quite a different scheme with their PhDs. They have a lot longer to do their PhDs, but they also have a lot more requirements, and they also seem to have a lot more funding than we do, or at least the lab that I was at did. And maybe because of that, there's a lot more competition within their labs, and it felt less collaborative and more competitive. So spending 6 months in the US also allowed me to reflect a bit on my time at Forest and what I thought Forest does differently. So we're all keeping on the same theme of creating a pack mentality. So I think one thing that Forest is really brilliant at is creating support networks, as we've heard from both of the other speakers. But for me, traditionally in your PhD, your main community is sort of made up by your research group or maybe your school, which can be really great for technical support and things, but if you have any issues with your research group or school, it can be quite isolating and difficult to find help if you need some help externally. And so Forest has a lot of external support across different disciplines and different institutions, and already I've found a major benefit from collaborating outside of my field. So when I came back from the US, I presented to Forest Hall, and just the questions and different perspectives that you get from presenting not just to your one field of research is really, really beneficial. The second point that I wanted to talk about is culturing an inclusive community. So as James mentioned, partners and families are encouraged to attend events at Forest Hall. And for me, this makes it a lot easier because it takes a lot of the pressure off and reduces the need to compromise between spending time with your friends and family and going to events that you think would actually help your professional development. And I think the other aspect of creating an inclusive community is the feeling that you're part of a group. It really reduces your vulnerability and sort of reduces the threshold to attending a lot of events. And I've heard across the last couple of days that some of the GRS have lots of events available, but it's very difficult to go to these alone. So having quite an inclusive community, it feels like you'll turn up and you'll see some of your friends, which is a really great benefit of Forest Hall. And thirdly, again, James has alluded to this a lot, curated professional development. So having courses, workshops and seminars, both externally and internally provided to people at Forest Hall has been a really, really great part of being part of Forest Hall. And having these events sort of readily available and they're advertised to you and to some extent they're curated makes the process a lot simpler, as you don't have to spend your precious PhD time seeking out these opportunities for yourself. And there's also a really broad range of professional development opportunities, as it's not necessarily just your field. It's quite a much broader range than I've seen advertised by my school. So some of the barriers that I've faced, I think resourcing, everyone knows that's a problem, but I've seen some real disparities in resourcing between universities and within universities between departments. And when you're doing a PhD, fighting for these resources that are sort of required for you to be able to do a PhD has been quite a struggle. And I think some of these difficulties are amplified by having quite a low stipend in some cases. Another barrier that we've all sort of talked about a little bit over the last few days as well is this lack of cohort identity. And starting a PhD can be quite overwhelming. You might be starting at a new university or a new city or even a new country, and having to navigate these new systems by yourself can be really difficult and isolating to do this. And I think not having a sense of who your peers are can be very difficult. We're very lucky at Forest Hall that we do have a cohort that we sort of move through. But outside of that, within your own university, it can be quite difficult. So if I could change one thing about the PhD experience, I initially wrote funding for this, but I don't think that's particularly helpful because everyone knows that. So I actually asked my lab mates, what would you change? And they said they wanted to see the universities provide structured understanding of pathways beyond the PhD. I'm sort of getting to the point in my PhD where I would like to start thinking about what I'm going to do after my PhD, and having some support to PhD students to sort of take advantage of the opportunities available to them to smoothen the transition into the next stage of their careers, I think would be extremely beneficial. So that's all from me. Thank you so much for your attention. I'll pass back to James.
Hi, everyone. We've got 2 minutes to go, so we haven't really got much time for questions, and I don't want to be in the way of morning tea. But I'm happy. Obviously, we're happy to chat during the morning tea break, but if there's any burning questions or anything from anyone, we're happy to answer them. I just think first-year PhD students just completed their first year. Pretty amazing, hey? Like, I think they deserve another round of applause.
Thanks, James. Yeah, it was a fantastic presentation. I guess what came out from the students who presented was that change in mindset around publish or perish, and rather flourishing. And I wondered if Forest provides training for the supervisors who are involved, because I feel like perhaps some of them might still be in that publish or perish mindset.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Look, when I first started as a director, one of the first things I wanted to do was invite supervisors in. And the message I got from the council was, do not invite supervisors in. They keep them at arm's length. We need a space away from them. So what I've tried to do is build relationships with each of the supervisors. And that's generally basically 60 supervisors. So I'm lucky I'm overseeing 60 researchers, and so it's I can tell you what everyone's research, and I can tell you what everyone's doing, and I can tell you what stage they're up and what they're struggling on and what they want to do next. I'm lucky in that sense because it's so defined. But what I do want to do is I want to move work. I have done some work at UNDA at Notre Dame about working with supervisors there. We've never had anyone from UNDA at the foundation. And we've been working with them to identify potential PhDs and postdocs that would fit. But yeah, I'm really keen to work with supervisors, and I think that as our program matures, then working with supervisors in the next phase would be really valuable. Got another question over there? Probably the last one, sorry.
I'd like to share my experience as a PhD student a while ago. Because I come from non-English speaking background, right, with the cultural differences between my country and Australia. What I said to my supervisors, like, look, apart from you are my supervisors, I'd like to also to build a relationship like parents and children. So I position myself as a child and you're my parents. So whatever you do to me, I accept that, and I don't mind you say something that unnecessary, for example, whatever, because I heard a lot of stories about PhD students, And it worked. So I finished my PhD a bit earlier, and the most thing that I'll never forget is he gave me his motorbike as a gift. So that's my experience. So I treat them like that relationship. Yeah, so I know it's hard, it's a pain, but yeah, it worked. Thank you.
Wow, okay. But look, I think there's something really interesting about, obviously we know the challenge that international students face as PhDs, and there's a whole bunch of challenges. And you know, you heard from Ming Jing and some of the challenges he waited. He had to wait 3 years to get approval to get here. COVID got in the way, but we've had a number of our researchers who've spent, like literally got stuck somewhere, crossing into, after they've submitted their PhD, they've gone to a conference, they've come back, they haven't got their marks back yet, and then they've not been allowed back in the country. So we've had phone calls coming through at 2 a.m. in the morning, you know, 2 a.m. saying, oh, I'm, you know, immigration won't let me in because apparently I've submitted and I'm not allowed back in because my PhD. So yeah, so that international aspect is something that we, as an industry and as a sector, really need to work on. But yeah, but it's great to see those positive experiences. And you know, and as Ming Xing's needed, I think you're you know, I mean, I won't put words in your mouth, but you know, you've had to navigate a whole bunch of cultural changes. Yeah, can I tell them about your language thing? Is that okay?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah, you tell them quickly. Last thing.
Oh yeah. So with this language thing, I think this I can break it into two parts. So the first thing is that, so my group is majorly consisting of students coming from China. And once they arrive in Australia, I try to speak them in English. And however, after a year, they ended up just in their comfort zone and they cannot speak. And what I really found shocking is that, despite some of my effort trying to help them, you know, adjust to the Austrian culture and try to speak out a little bit, when they are writing their thesis and also when they are reading papers, what they do is that, I mean, turn up Google Translate and just read the whole paper from Chinese and write everything in Chinese and just translate that into English. So it's like, well, I can help you with that, but yeah, I mean, this is not easy for them, but I feel there's more support that we can give them. From the institution.
Okay, look, well, thank you so much for listening, and I'll pass it back to Alistair. And yeah, we're going to be around for a bit if you want to talk to us afterwards. Thank you.